This bit's in the middle of your handbook, but I thought I should put it first because this is the real crux of the matter. So I thought I'd jump to the chase, give you this in case you fall asleep later in my talk. So as pediatricians, we think the three or four biggest health problems in kids relate to these three things, plus maybe obesity. And they are teenage sleep deprivation. What's more scary is the rate of increase. It's increased from 35% of teenagers to 70% in the last 12 to 15 years. In parallel, mental health problems, as you'll hear lots about this today, have increased at a similarly alarming rate, 27% per year. That equates to tripling since 2008. And in parallel, learning issues in our teenagers have become more problematic. So looking at things like PISA scores, the Program for International Student Assessment in our 15-year-olds, we've gone from top 12 in the early 2000s to 39th out of 41 or 42 high and middle income countries. So the real crux of the question is, are these three things related or are they coincidental? So what I want to convince you of today is that they are related. So the reason I know this is because I see lots of tired, sleepy teenagers, and most of them have mood disorders, and many of them have suboptimal learning. And when we improve their sleep, get them more regular, nourishing, better quality sleep, their moods improve, their learning and concentration improves. And some of them lose the medical labels that they come with. Some of them come as anxiety disorders, ADHD, ODD, oppositional defiant disorder. And in some of these kids, when you fix their sleep, those medical labels go away because those labels are subsequent to their poor sleep. So we think they're all linked, and therefore it's not surprising that as mental health and sleep health gets worse, learning problems become more apparent. So in the medical world, and perhaps the education world, sleep problems get a little bit dismissed. They go under the radar. So the key reason to speak to you today is to tell you about all these concepts and explain to you how you can help in fixing them. So the outline of what I want to do today is make some general points, tell you how sleepy our teens are, give you some figures, talk about electronic screens, talk more fully about the interaction between moods and learning and sleep, and then we'll get practical. I'll tell you about different disorders that we see. So sleep deprivation is not just about not having enough sleep. Some of these kids have insomnias. They have the inability to sleep. So it's not purely a behavioral or a choice thing. It's a mixture of sleep disorders and unwillingness to sleep. So I'll give you some strategies, and then I'll tell you what we do with people that you fail to help right at the end. So I should talk about the things I'm not going to talk about today, and people say, why don't you talk about drugs? Why don't you talk about blue light filters on screens? It's because they're gimmicks, they're not solutions. So we'll get them out of the way by not talking about them. One of the gimmicks is this fantastic thing. I think it's hilarious. It's a face-slapping alarm clock. So this was invented by an Englishman who was frustrated by the inability to get his teenage daughter out of bed. So when the alarm goes off, the horizontal plastic arm swings down vertically and hits this young lady either in the forehead or the back of the head, depending which way she's lying. So it's funny, but it's not a solution. So just some general points. The three pillars of health in teenagers: good sleep, good nutrition, exercise. It is amazing how protective these things are. So the teenagers that have these three things in place are mentally and physically protected from a whole host of other disorders. And they're particularly protected when stress comes. So good sleep gives them a degree of resilience. So without sounding like an American preacher at a royal wedding, I have to try and convince you that, and Andrew convinced you by saying, how many of you guys get tired or have a sleep problem? It is incredibly common, and it is becoming more common. If you want to know how common something is, you can go to Google. And if you type in, why am I, the first thing that comes up, why am I always tired? So this is the most Googled personal question worldwide. And in our sleepy world, teenagers are the sleepiest. They're the sleepiest group. So currently about 70% of Australian teenagers are sleep deprived. This means chronically tired on school days, doubled in the last 15 years. In the Sleepy Olympics, our teenagers come third. They get the bronze medal, equal with the USA. Korean kids are the tiredest. South Korean kids. We can't get figures on North Korean kids. So why are they tired? As always with teenagers, it's never simply one factor. There's a whole lot of factors. Some of those are listed on the right. They compound and form a recipe which we call a perfect storm. So when we try and help with sleep deprivation, we're looking at all these factors, behavioral factors, psychological factors. I've just ticked the ones if you wanted to know the top three in this recipe, perhaps social media, social connectedness, Netflix addiction, screen use at night. That's the big thing that's changed in the last 10 to 15 years. So fear of missing out, FOMO, is a powerful dependence. I'll talk about late body clocks, which is important in teenagers. And a lot of the kids I see are driven by ambition and pressure. And particularly in a lot of the private school kids, they're very much overscheduled. And their overscheduling stresses them, and it also limits their sleep, gives them less sleep opportunity, and the stress tends to stop them from getting to sleep when they want to. And the effects of all this go way beyond tiredness, learning problems, and moods. All these factors are well researched and proven. So an hour of lost sleep in a teenager equals a 58% increase in suicide risk. If we lose an hour of sleep, it doesn't affect our suicide risk at all. Anxiety, depression, 15 times more likely in sleep-deprived kids. School lateness, cyberbullying, all these things are increased. Things that you wouldn't expect, unwanted teenage pregnancies, triple in sleep-deprived girls. Motor vehicle accidents, in parts of the US now, they are starting to give kids late school starting times, allowing them to sleep in. This is particularly helpful for the kids with late body clocks. And they've measured things like motor vehicle accidents. So allowing kids to start school 2 hours later reduces the number of motor vehicles in the subsequent year by 25 to 30% for teenage drivers. This causes family relationship breakdowns. Parents who never see their kids because they're either awake in their room doing stuff or sleeping it off on weekends. Kids lose their sense of humor. They have impaired moral and ethical judgment. Part of the reason for this is that the teenage brain is unique. The two, I think, outstanding features that contribute to this are two bits of the brain, the limbic system, which is our emotional brain, that's the purple bit in the center, and the prefrontal cortex, which is on the right-hand side. The prefrontal cortex is a rational, sensible brain. It's the bit of your brain that stops you doing stupid things. And if you get too emotional, the prefrontal cortex dampens down your emotion. So what happens at night with teenagers, particularly girls, the limbic system, the emotional brain, fires up as they get tighter and tighter. Rather than going to sleep, this bit of the brain ramps up and the prefrontal cortex goes to sleep. And in fact, the prefrontal cortex in lots of teenagers is relatively immature compared to the rest of the brain. So late at night, one bit of the brain is all emotional and fired up. The rational bit is not suppressing the emotions. And this explains why cyberbullying and emotionality and risk-taking behavior is at high levels late at night. And a lot of these kids are then remorseful the next day when the prefrontal cortex has woken up. They say, what I did last night, that cyberbullying I did was the wrong thing to do. So this is the sort of the all petrol, no brakes situation. So let's move on to screens. There's a tsunami of information about this stuff. This is 30,000 teenagers researched across 50 US states. And you all know this, ubiquitous use of phones, screens in the hour before bedtime. The researchers found that certain screen activities are worse for sleep than others, so active activities like electronic messaging and gaming, much worse for your sleep than passive things like TV and DVDs. Not many kids turn their phone off at night. The electronic messaging was rife, so this was measured objectively through telcos. Most teenagers said, yeah, I might text once or twice at night. Average number of electronic messages at night after 9 p.m. was 34. Some kids were over 100. No difference between weeknights and school nights, suggesting that there's not a lot of insight in the teenagers about the negative impact of usage. Not surprisingly, 77% reported difficulties, either getting to sleep or morning tiredness. A third of them were having two or more energy drinks a day, which is a good surrogate measure of sleep deprivation. And a quarter of them were taking stimulants. So in the US now, stimulants are not called stimulants, they're called smart drugs. They make you smarter by waking your brain up. So a quarter of these high school kids, by their own admission, were taking things to keep them awake. So screens are particularly bad because they do four things to your sleep, not one thing. This picture on the right is a girl who fell asleep with her smartphone and the screen burnt her during the night. So the first factor is screen time delays bedtime, like any other awake activity. The second thing that it does, it's a dependency, it's fun, it's highly addictive. When you do something that's fun and addictive, you get neurochemicals that are released that help with your dependence. Now, these neurochemicals tend to wake you up. Dopamine, adrenaline. Cortisol levels also go up when kids are tired. So cortisol is your stress hormone. So even when the screen activity stops, a lot of the kids can't get to sleep because the neurochemicals are still floating around, keeping them awake. The third thing is that as the devices have become smaller and more portable, they're more likely to be used on the bed rather than at a desk. And this, in some kids, will blur the boundary between awake activities and bed activities. And some brains get a mixed message. It's like the kids, the brain does not realize what the bed's for. The brain thinks the bed's for a place of wakefulness. And the Americans have quaintly termed this conditioned arousal. And this leads to a problem called conditioned insomnia. Essentially, this is the brain being trained to be awake in bed. So because the brain's neuroplastic, if you train it to do something, it will continue to do something. So if these kids lie awake in or on the bed for a long time, they get conditioned arousal and conditioned insomnia. The two screen activities that cause the most conditioned insomnia are gaming and electronic messaging. And electronic messaging, interestingly, it's not sending the message that's excitatory, it's waiting for the return message. And that expectant wait, the longer you wait, the more wakeful you become. That's called infomania. So this person, this is not my patient, this is a colleague's patient, he had the phone in his bed when he fell asleep, and the charger, the charging cable got looped around his neck, it short-circuited, and it burnt and partially electrocuted him. So don't sleep with your phone. So the fourth effect is this blue light effect, which I'm sure you all know well. Blue light, any light signals the brain to be awake, but blue light more so. As screens become smaller, the amount of blue light that they emit increases. So big screens, big TVs, don't emit nearly as much blue light as little screens. The blue light is needed to give clarity. So the smaller the screen, the more blue light needed to make what you're looking at clear. And of course, the smaller the screen, the closer to the face. So the blue light effect is really a signal to the brain to wake up. We use light as therapy for some of these kids in the morning, in fact, to wake them up, not screen light, but sunlight. This was from your esteemed newspaper, the Brisbane Times, earlier in the year. The amazing discovery that kids who spend less time in front of screens are happier, yet the kids tell me, if I play Minecraft for 2 hours, I'm really happy. If I play it for 4 hours, I'm twice as happy. But there comes a point where screens lower your mood. And these researchers found that the two key things that screens did to lower your mood and make you less happy were social isolation and sleep deprivation. So although they're fun, they're not always fun. So we preach this thing of having a balance, which is all simple and common sense, a bit more sleep, a bit more green time or exercise, and a bit less screen time to get a sort of healthy balance. I want to talk about learning and sleep, and there's two sort of key things to tell you. One is about the relationship between tiredness and learning in the classroom, and we can equate it to you guys. So if all you guys had a good sleep last night, you can listen to all of us today, and all the information you hear will be absorbed into your brain, into short-term memory. If any of you had a rough night last night, didn't get much sleep, and you're really, really tired, your brain will be in cognitive shutdown, and you won't absorb much of this information. So this is what teachers and parents always rage about, in one ear and out the other. So to get short-term memory, you need a good sleep the night before your learning experience. The second bit you need to retain memory, so if your spouse says, get milk on the way home, you don't need to remember that long-term. But in a classroom, if you want to achieve long-term memory, you've got to shift the learning from short-term memory banks to long-term memory banks in your brain. So that shift into long-term memory only occurs in dream sleep, rapid eye movement sleep. And therefore, after a day's learning experience, you need a good night's sleep in order to consolidate the learning, to transfer it into long-term memory. If that sleep's a bad sleep, a few days later you have forgotten, and we call that futile learning. And there's a lot of research about the relationship between academic achievement in kids and sleep, and we know that smart, high-achieving kids sleep longer, they sleep better, they sleep more regularly, and as you go down the academic centiles, sleep deprivation becomes more common. The other thing to mention is this learning at night, homework and study. So what we see a lot of is that in the evening and at night, tired teenagers get tighter, and as they become tighter, their brain slows down. As their brain slows down, their study and homework takes longer to complete. So we see kids who say, I get 5 hours homework, I can't get to bed on time, and we say, it's not 5 hours homework, it takes you 5 hours because you're tired and because you're distracted, and in that 5 hours you're doing other stuff. So bedtime's delayed because of cognitive slowing, so the sleep time's reduced, and this repeats the next day. So again, that evening's learning, if it's not followed by a good sleep, it's not consolidated into long-term memory. So we call that futile learning, and it's wasted. Now again, on the right, this is PISA scores of literacy and numeracy. The other factor in this, as you know, is science. Pretty much a year-by-year decline in Australian kids as their sleep deprivation increases and their mental health gets worse. So here we go from top 12 in the early 2000s to 39th. And the political and leadership response to this is two things usually. Blame teachers, blame education, blame school, and then throw some money at the problem. So Mr. Gonski's thrown $28 billion, which is fantastic. Our state government, New South Wales, last year threw an extra $2.2 billion in 1 year to education in response to these poor learning outcomes. Now that is fantastic. However, you've got to spend it on the right thing. I don't think it's really about the teachers and the schools so much as about mental and sleep health. So if I ever got to meet Mr. Gonski, I would ask him, could he spend some money on sleep health? And we think sleep education should be part of every school's curriculum. And in fact, the flagship school in Australia for sleep health in teenagers is one of your schools in Brisbane, Brisbane Boys Grammar. So David Carroll, who's the vice headmaster, has met with us, and he had already achieved a lot of what we would desire. And I said to him, you don't need my help because you've already done all this stuff. He instituted it initially, a sleep health program for athletes, because there's a lot of data that if athletes sleep better, they perform better. NBA basketball now has sleep coaches. because research demonstrated that even things like half an hour more sleep for elite basketball players increases their stats, their reflexes, their rebounds, their shooting. The sleep health program at Brisbane Boys was so successful with athletes, they've now translated it to the whole high school. And it's got a lot of components. It's not just about teaching good health. Teaching it alone to kids doesn't fix them. It's a partnership between the school and the parents and the students. They recognize very well this problem of overscheduling. Too much stuff, too little sleep, bad moods, bad learning. And that's really important. So they've got a balance between homework, study, and sleep needs. They're now undertaking a trial of late school starting time one day a week to look at the positive impacts of that. And if that works well, which I think it will, they will extend that to the whole school. So we hope other schools follow. So let's move on to the relationship between psychological things, mood, and sleep. This is really interesting because it's bi-directional. So what this means is that, for example, I'm anxious, my anxiety stops me from getting to sleep. Equally, the other way around is I can't get to sleep, not being able to get to sleep makes me anxious. So this is why mood problems and sleep problems tend to go together. But a lot of the kids we see, once they get labeled with a mood problem, their sleep is not addressed. It's almost as if to say, well, you know, they've just got depression. Part of the treatment of depression is the treatment of sleep. So if you have a depressed teenager who's a poor sleeper, you need to treat both mood and sleep. So my favorite, there's a lot of research on this, my favorite bit is this lady, Mary Cascaden. She's a guru researcher. She's been researching teenage sleep since the late 70s. And one of her recent studies was to look at the relationship between stress, sleep, and moods. You're not allowed to stress teenagers to do experiments on them. It's unethical. So she got them at a stressful time, college entry, university entrance. So in the US, as you know, most kids, when they go to uni, college, they go to a different city. So they leave their family, they leave their friends, they leave their town, they don't know anyone. It's a stressful time. She measured in a bunch of students their vulnerability to depression. You can measure this now. In our DNA, there's a thing called the serotonin transporter gene. If you've got a short copy of that, that means you're vulnerable to depression. If you've got a normal copy, you're not genetically vulnerable. And she measured their sleep and she did mood scores. So what she found is that any student with poor sleep and genetic vulnerability to depression, as soon as they went to college, they became depressed. If they had the same genetic vulnerability to depression, but they had a good sleep pattern, they went to college, their mood score stayed the same. They didn't become depressed. And we know this in practice. So sleep deprivation plus genetic vulnerability to depression, anxiety, whatever, plus stress is a disaster. Everything unravels. You can't change genetics. You can't avoid stress. Our young people will be faced with stresses. They come. But if you train sleep and regulate it, it gives you resilience in the time of stress. So that's the theoretical bit. This is the practical bit. What are the sleep problems that we see? We see four things. We see voluntary sleep restriction, which is just the kids who choose not to sleep too much. They're the group that you can help a lot by the strategies that I'll talk about at the end of this talk. And then there's three other groups. Those with insomnia, the true inability to sleep. They can have a late body clock, they can have conditioned insomnia, which I've mentioned, or they can have psychological insomnia, which is the inability to get to sleep because of their primary mood problem. And that's a nice way to think about it. In practice, a lot of kids we see have combinations of those four things. Part of the problem about the amount of sleep kids need is what science says and what society says is different. So in real life, our teenagers on average drop from about 9 hours of sleep average age 12 to 7 to 7.5 by the end of high school. What research shows is that the sleep need through teenage years stays static. So it's about 9 hours at age 12 and it's about 9 hours at age 17. I find it very hard to sell this to teenagers in upper high school. They say, what do you mean? I'm 16 and I need the same amount of sleep as my 12-year-old brother. You're dreaming. But that's the research. So educationalists, as you know, tend to fit more with the social norm. So more homework, more study as you go through high school, with the expectation that older kids need a later bedtime. But it's good to be aware of that. We had the luck to survey through Generation Next recently a bunch of several thousand teenagers, Australian teenagers, how much sleep do they get? This is anonymous, so it's probably honest. Only 7% had adequate sleep, and about 75% had less than 8 hours. So that fits in with our figure of about 70-75% of kids sleep deprived. So late body clocks. This is an important thing to get. This is not a behavioural thing, this is a medical thing. A big percentage of teenagers, as they go through puberty or a bit before, their sleep-wake body clock shifts to the right, it shifts later. So they are very wired and awake at night, late at night, and conversely are tired and sleepy in the morning, the reverse of what they should be. So this is like how we feel with jet lag. They're very slow to do things, hard to get out of bed, slow to dress, slow to have breakfast. And that slowness is called sleep inertia. So what this means is that this bunch of teenagers are misaligned with school starting times. And this is why late school starting times for them works really well. The school is fitting in with their body clock. And so we are advocates for that. When you have a late body clock, your melatonin, your sleep hormone, increases at night later than average. So the late body clock teenager on that graph is the green part, and the normal teenager is the blue part. So if you have a low melatonin at your bedtime, you feel wide awake, and conversely, if your melatonin in the morning is high, you feel sleepy. So again, like jet lag, we surveyed the same teenagers about this, described what it's like to be an owl, 50% said that's how they feel every morning. So let's get on to treatment. First bit of treatment is picking which kids to treat and to target with these strategies. Sometimes it's obvious. So you can look at that girl on the right. She didn't care that I took her photo. I asked her permission. She said yes. She didn't want to know what it's going to be used for, but gave me permission. I said, do you want to straighten your hair? And she said, no. She was tired, she had a low mood. So you can look at her and say, this is obvious, she's bedraggled, she's inattentive, she's not engaged, she's away with the fairies. Tired body language. Sometimes kids don't have tired body language, so you can ask two questions to determine. They're called red flag questions. And they are, do you have big weekend sleep-ins? That's catch up sleep from the sleep debt during the week. Or are you very difficult or hard to get out of bed on school mornings? So if yes is the answer to those questions, you've got a sleep-deprived teenager. If it's no, you haven't. And then I think I would encourage you to be proactive. So here are the strategies. And again, these are all written in the handbook. And with any strategy with teenagers, there's always obstruction and blockages. And the main blockage, the main road hump is teenagers themselves. They're not too interested in sleep stuff. It's not a high priority. They think that being awake is much more fun than being asleep. And sleep deprivation is normalized amongst teenagers. It's so common that they say, well, you know, all my friends are like me, and so it's okay. Sleep health is not sexy or cool, and it's really hard to sell to teenagers. So what we do is sell it to parents. So, parents are the conduits, you guys become the directors. What you've then got to overcome is parents who are disempowered, parents who are not willing to push and make change. So your encouragement will be very helpful for them. Any professional encouragement is helpful. Do it the earlier that we get asked, when should you do it, the earlier the better. Our success rate through high school at correcting sleep deprivation goes like that. And by the last 2 years of high school, it's really, really hard to fix because there's so much pressure, there's so much stress, moods are so low. So we're now seeing kids with this sort of thing, late body clocks and so on, as young as 9 and 10. If you get to them early, you can nip it in the bud. Teenagers can do a lot of stuff, but they, in general, they won't manage by themselves their sleep, particularly boys. Boys don't manage stuff well in the evenings either. So direction from you to parents is a good idea. What we encourage you to do first is for parents to sit down and have a meeting and say, Mr. Smith has expressed concern about your tiredness, your mood, your learning. We want to have a chat about your sleep pattern. And put your cards on the table and ask the teenager what they would like to change. Name one thing. And it can be one thing out of any of the following. Because if you do get that engagement, a little bit of traction, that is really good. Parents then reach a point where they say, look, I've got some traction or I haven't. We then encourage them to move on to these things. Evening efficiencies are really important, and it sounds simplistic, but again, boys in particular are hopeless, or the ones I see are hopeless at organising their evening. Everything goes slowly, so their bedtime's delayed. So having parents to say, look, we're going to have dinner a bit earlier, we'll have a bit of a timetable, and we will support you during this evening time so you can have your social time, your screen time, schoolwork, and so on. The next thing is to make sure bedtime and lights out is the same thing. Teenagers will usually buy into this because this is one of the easier things to do. Don't do anything in or on the bed that's not sleep to avoid that conditioned arousal thing that I mentioned. So that's really easy, relatively. The really, really hard one is the talk about screens. Separating teenagers and their screens at night is hard. There's the fear of missing out effect. There's the dependency effect. All of that. Ideally, we want no electronic screens in the hour before bedtime and no screens during the night. And I think the best way to manage this is by compromise and negotiation. But sometimes it requires more force. And again, parents are often disempowered to do this. But ultimately, having a talk about an electronic device to limit electronic screens is sometimes needed. So the one I'm accustomed to is called Family Zone. It's cyber limiting, which is good. It works for little kids as well as older kids, and it's time limited by parents. Sometimes even talking about this, parents talking about it, the threat of it, is enough to change behavior. But that's a big step for parents, and parents will often get stuck in this conundrum of, I want to act in my child's best interests, I also want to be friends with them, and I also want them to have independence. So that is the conundrum. So you will help probably about 80% of sleep-deprived kids by doing those strategies. The others, we can help. And if you lived in Sydney, we could see your teenagers at our multidisciplinary clinic. We have a clinic with psychologists and educationalists and counsellors and sleep doctors like me. But in Brisbane, there's no such clinic, but we have an online version called Sleep Shack, which I encourage you to have a look at, and I encourage you to get parents to have a look at as a first step. So sometimes the failures just mean there's low motivation, there's not much insight, families can be chaotic and disorganized, and kids with a really late body clock or significant psychological issues often don't respond totally to the strategies I gave you, and we then go and do sleep boot camp. So I won't detail Sleep Shack, but essentially it's multidisciplinary treatment. We treat all the aspects of sleep deprivation, behavior, psychology, circadian rhythm, body clocks, and so on. There are no drugs. If you have any questions about it, you can email us through Sleep Shack. Resources for you. We have in-school sleep seminars. We can come to Brisbane. I don't do them. One of my colleagues does them. That's the Sleep Connection. Jen Neck's book, which is here, Nurturing Young Minds, one of the chapters we've written about sleep, which expands on what we've talked about today. And some take-home points. I won't read through them all. Just to say, when you see now an unhappy, grumpy, lazy, moody teenager who has no engagement with you whatsoever and is not learning well, you can almost bet your bottom dollar they're sleep deprived. Thanks for listening.